The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. I hope this is causing a pleasant diversion. How are you doing? It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, I was reading over the past few weeks, people having bad days where they were crying and stuff, and I found it really hard. I had two bad days this week where I really struggled. Kids and everything. It's just... Anyway, I hope you're doing all right. And I hope this is, as I say, some sort of distraction over the next hour or less where we talk about what's going on in the world. If you would like to contact the program, we'd love to hear your emails, particularly now. Let us know what you think of the stories and if you have your own experiences. science@newstalk.com is the email. You can also find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Coming up on the show, we're going to be speaking to Andreas Hein. He's from the Initiative for Interstellar Studies, and he's going to be telling us about the four current ideas behind how we can get the human race from this star to the next one. And there are some really, really weird ideas that I think you'll enjoy, all of them being pursued in one way or another by research at the moment. Before we go into the week's science news, I wanted to let you know about FameLab. FameLab is an international science communications competition where scientists get up on stage and they give a talk for 3 minutes about anything. And actually, they could be studying science or working in science or technology or engineering. And the idea is that you have to wow someone with an idea over 3 minutes. And the final of the Irish competition is happening this Wednesday. So if you're listening now, it's the 15th of April at 6 p.m. till 7:30 p.m. It's a great night. It was out and now it's a great night in. Do check it out. facebook.com/British Council Ireland. It's just something else to do and it's very family friendly as well. All right. Looking back at the week's science news, we're joined by Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen. She's a real doctor. He's not really useful in many practical situations. You're both very welcome. Our first story is just an update on where we are with the COVID stuff. I keep being told by my editor that because we're the science program, we should probably tell people about where we are with the biggest pandemic and human challenge that this generation and even generations before have ever seen. So where are we with the treatments? We're talking about antibodies a couple of weeks ago, Lara. There's a new paper out on plasma.
Yeah, and you're dead right. I mean, it's hard to know whether people want to know more about COVID-19 or they want to be distracted and talk about something else. But I think it's right that we have, you know, someone who can update about COVID-19 and then Shane who can talk about absolute crap. So I suppose we're giving both sides of the story. But the new update on the antibodies, for anyone who wasn't listening 2 weeks ago, we were talking about how people who have recovered from the disease will have antibodies to it. And in theory, you can then use those antibodies to give them to someone who is sick from the disease and they will help to make that person better. If you want to kind of oversimplify it, it's a bridge to eventually having a vaccine that works. And it's a bridge to get these people to feel better. It won't give them permanent immunity to the disease, but it might potentially help and has done in other diseases in the past. 2 weeks ago, I was a little bit scathing about using this treatment in seriously ill people. I personally didn't think it was really going to be effective. There's two papers out now. One is published in JAMA, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's one of the most highly ranked papers or journals, sorry, in the world. And then there is another one published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I'm kind of frustrated because these two papers, if it weren't about coronavirus and we weren't in the middle of the pandemic, or there's zero chance that they would have been published. Essentially, what they're saying is they looked at 10 and in the PNAS study and 5 in the JAMA study, critically ill patients, and they gave them the antibodies. And what they said was that they did very well. In the 10 patients, they said that 3 of them are now completely discharged from the hospital and 7 are on their way to being discharged, which is fantastic news. And I am absolutely delighted. And these people were very unwell. The 5 patients in the JAMA study were all on ventilators and 3 of them are now off ventilators. So it is very interesting, but to me, a study without a control, so they don't have controls in this study. Now, in one of the papers, they looked at 10 patients who didn't get the antibodies. It wasn't a control. They just picked 10 random patients after they'd done their study and just fitted them in. These patients were all getting different medications as well. So different antivirals, different amounts of steroids, all sorts of different things. There was just no control in any of these. To me, it's equivocal of giving a puppy to someone with a cold and then a week later saying, oh my God, look, the puppy made them better. You know, it's not.
Can puppies do that?
Yes. Absolutely. You know, as long as you've got no control, then I can say whatever I want about the puppy study.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not saying that this isn't a really good potential treatment. It is. It's a really good potential treatment. But I think we need to be very careful in the middle of this pandemic about publishing things, about rushing into doing treatments and deciding on things that are potentially going to heal people when without doing the science behind it, because we are all terrified of the pandemic. I'm not saying don't work fast, but I'm saying we still need to work well.
So what about this BCG stuff then? Because Professor Luke O'Neill was tweeting about it, saying that did seem to be a correlation, although he did put caveats on it, between people who've had the BCG jab, which is most of Ireland, and low serious response to COVID.
I think this is absolutely fascinating, the BCG study. So there was a statistical analysis done on 178 countries looking at ones that routinely give BCG. So BCG is a vaccine that is traditionally given for treatment against TB, but they have more recently discovered that it starts to reduce levels of pneumonia in certain people. It's also treatment that's used for bladder cancer. Interestingly, it's instilled into the bladder and it can help treat superficial bladder cancer in people. And what it does is it activates the innate immune response. So that's your first line of defense. So that's not things like antibodies. That's the very first line, the cells that are there to attack arbitrarily anything that enters the body without it being specialized. And it's an incredibly important part of our immune response. And in countries that have a routine BCG vaccination, so for instance, Ireland or Portugal, compared to countries that don't have as much in terms of routine vaccination, they stopped vaccinating in the UK in 2005, and they don't seem to have had as big a vaccination program as Ireland has had. There is 10 times increased number of infections in these countries. And to be honest, I don't rate the number of infections. I think that's almost irrelevant because that depends on how much you're testing.
Yeah.
But what they've also found is that there's 10 times an increased rate of death from COVID-19 in countries without BCG vaccinations. Hmm. So, I mean, it's very hard to fudge these numbers. Like, we're talking about the death rate in countries that do have a BCG vaccination is around about 4 people per million. And those without BCG, it's 40 people per million.
Right.
I mean, that is a massive increase. And I think it's fascinating if you think about Spain versus Portugal, Spain, which doesn't routinely vaccinate with BCG, and Portugal, which does. There's a huge border along those two countries, yet the death toll is drastically different. And it's hard to say what it's causing it, but, you know, BCG could be a huge part of it. We stopped vaccinating in 2015 in Ireland for BCG simply because we ran out. But hopefully we can ramp up production. Now, I'm not saying this is going to be the answer to this current coronavirus, although they are in the Netherlands vaccinating 1,000 people in a clinical trial. And in Australia, they're vaccinating a huge number of healthcare workers. And these are controlled trials. But we have no idea what a vaccination will do in an adult as compared to a child.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of caveats to this, but it's just fascinating, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm looking at it from a purely scientific point of view. What's amazing is that it's also potentially saving lives. But just from a science point of view, it is absolutely amazing.
Okay, Shane, our second story has to do with a plastic eating enzyme. Now, we've covered this approach to the plastic problem many times. And yet this seems to be something a bit more promising than some of the other technologies, which sometimes could take forever and seem completely impractical.
Yeah, and it starts with absolute crap, which is basically in 2016 on your program, Jonathan, we talked about scientists who had found a bacteria in a Japanese dump.
Yeah.
And that was able to eat PET plastic, which is the plastic that your fizzy drinks come in. And it does so because it developed an enzyme that was able to digest the plastic. And so it was basically in an environment that was very rich in plastic. It was its only food source. And so it evolved very quickly to be able to eat plastic. However, it's very slow. And so it wasn't going to really be a useful way for us to reduce the amount of plastic that we have and that we throw into the oceans and landfill. Then in 2018, by accident, other scientists tweaked that enzyme whilst trying to understand its mechanism. And they made it they made it better. So they mutated this enzyme, and they made its ability to consume plastic more efficient. And so that was great. And they said at the end of that paper that what we need to do is really ramp this up and to improve it even further. They needed to be able to understand the mechanism and to transfer it into what's called an extremophile bacteria, something that can operate at hot temperatures, which would increase the rate at which the plastic is consumed. And that's what this paper that was published just recently this week has done. They have taken mutant bacterial enzymes that are able to eat plastic bottles in hours. And
which is like huge, because of course eating this plastic bottle is number one, getting rid of the plastic, but the waste is actually what's exciting.
So they looked for, they had 100,000 candidates to use, and they found that a bacteria from leaf mold was the place to go. Something that people are probably spreading on their gardens as they listen to the show. This is the time of year for it. And so within that, they were able to take out the enzyme and they were able to mutate it. And it was able to consume the plastic in your fizzy drink bottle at 72 degrees. And it was able to, within 10 hours, degrade 90% of the bottle. And then they were crucially able to recycle it to make new plastic bottles. Now, that is something that hasn't been able to be done before. So typically, when you see recyclable on a plastic bottle, it doesn't really mean recyclable. It means that you can repurpose what's in your plastic bottle to make other things like fleeces and stuff, you know, second generation products. But you can't make new plastic bottles.
Yeah, you can't make that high grade, high quality plastic that we use in food and in transport and so on. That the sort of products you get are, they're kind of, they don't require a high level of finish.
Absolutely. And that, of course, is just market driven. It's because we want to be able to see what's inside the plastic bottle when we're buying it. So the last piece of the jigsaw is to make this process commercially sensible, yeah, so that it is cheaper to make new bottles for your fizzy drink from existing plastic rather than use oil that's dug up from the ground.
Our third story, Lara, is back to COVID, but a novel idea of trying to fight like with like.
Yeah, just a really quick little update on the vaccine story, I suppose. One of the things we were talking about before is that a vaccine potentially will take 12 to 18 months to develop. But one way to do it faster is to adapt a vaccine that currently exists. And that's what they're doing in the University of Iowa. They have a vaccine that's working very well in mice against MERS, which is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which came out in 2012 and is also a coronavirus. And very interestingly, what they did was they took another virus, which is a virus that causes kennel cough in dogs, but it doesn't cause any disease symptoms in humans. It's called parainfluenza virus 5. And they adapted it to produce one of the proteins that MERS produces naturally. And when they vaccinated mice with this virus, and they also then vaccinated them with another type of MERS, and more traditional vaccine that they used MERS with, their virus, the parainfluenza virus, caused the mice to be 100% protected against a MERS infection, whereas the traditional vaccine, where they give live attenuated MERS to the mice, only caused 25% of the mice to survive the infection. So it's just an interesting idea how we can start to adapt things we already have. And maybe, now this has never even made it to human trials, so it's still not going to, in my opinion, be faster than 12 to 18 months. But it's just a really good idea to try and adapt things that already exist and to show that new and novel ways of making vaccines might be the answer.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm wondering, this is a joke, by the way. Okay, I feel like I need to flag these things now, but I'm wondering if we need a vaccine at all, because we have become so uncomfortable with people in our social circle now that I just don't think we won't need a vaccine by the time the vaccine comes around, because everyone will be like, get away from me, I need 2 meters. I feel sorry exactly for the lusty teenagers who would otherwise be out in the streets prowling and told to somethings, you know, the way you do, looking for the shift. It's just not happening. No one is getting the shift. Finally, Shane, this is an interesting one. We're going to put a telescope on the dark side of the moon.
we're going to think about putting a telescope on the dark side of the moon. So NASA have announced possible projects that they're willing to fund in the coming years. And they've given some seed funding to scientists who are interested in building a huge radio telescope on the far side of the moon. So this would be in a crater that's about 3 kilometers in diameter. And they're going to insert in it, if they get funding, a radio telescope that has a 1 kilometer diameter. This is incredible. So it would be able to look out to the edges of the universe to understand the very origins of the universe, to look at something called the epoch of reionization, to look at where the some of the earliest stars and galaxies were formed and how that reionized the early galaxy, areas that we're just not able to see. They're completely opaque to us at the moment. So we'd be probing the very, very early universe. And if you don't think that's cool and distracting at the moment, then I don't know what we have for you.
Why is the dark side of the moon a good place to put a telescope?
Well, firstly, it's it just like it sounds cool. I think that's one of the main things. So, no, there are science reasons. So you'd put it there basically because it's shielded from all of the radio noise that the Earth puts out, and indeed the sun sprays out as well. So during the lunar night at that side of the moon, it's completely shielded from both the noise from the Earth and from the sun. And right. So it's able to detect a kind of a cleaner signal from the area of the spectrum that it's very interested in. So there are radio telescopes on the Earth, one of which is in Burren County, Offaly, called ILOFAR. It's part of a pan-European radio telescope, but it has to compete with the likes of News Talk and other radio stations for bandwidth. And it also has the problem of the atmosphere of the Earth shielding out some of the radio waves from parts of the sky that they're interested in.
Very cool. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Laura Duggan, thanks very much for joining us. Chat to you next week. Now, a few weeks back, we talked to Chris Wanjek about human spacefaring, and he briefly talked about this idea of hollowing out an asteroid to use it as an interstellar spacecraft. And this got us thinking about the whole idea of interstellar travel. So we decided to find ourselves a scientist who was working on that very thing. Our regular listeners will probably be unsurprised to hear that there's not just one scientist engaged in this research, but numerous organizations. Well, Andreas Hein is the executive director of one such organization, the Initiative for Interstellar Studies. He joins me now. What is that lofty sounding group that you work for, Andreas? What is the Initiative for Interstellar Studies?
Yes, so the Initiative for Interstellar Studies is a UK-based not-for-profit company, which was founded in 2012. And we actually want to achieve interstellar travel, and we're doing research on different topics related to that, to achieving interstellar travel. And we also engage in educational activities.
So what exactly do you do there?
Yeah, so as an executive director, I'm actually coordinating the activities within our organization, which essentially means that I'm doing research on achieving interstellar travel. So this is like doing studies, doing research, developing new technologies. And there's also education, which means that we are giving lectures in collaboration with universities and also schools.
So what are the biggest stumbling blocks then to traveling as a species to another star system?
Yeah, so the main issue is obviously propulsion, because we need to achieve extremely high speeds to get to the next stars within our lifetimes. And that's really talking about like 100 times or maybe 1,000 times faster than currently existing spacecraft. So the fastest spacecraft we have today is the Voyager spacecraft, which have been launched into space in the 70s. And they are traveling at speeds of about like 17 kilometers per second. And just imagine a town which is like 15 kilometers to 20 kilometers from your place you are living at. And just imagine covering this distance within 1 second. And now we are talking about speeds which are like 100 times faster than that. So it's really extremely fast. And right now, we don't really have the propulsion systems to get up to these speeds. So this is one of the key issues we're talking about. But there are also a lot of other issues, like how to protect against interstellar particles, how to protect against radiation between the stars, and ultimately also how to actually break at the target star system. So this is something which sounds counterintuitive, but if you are traveling at these speeds, I mean, imagine you are traveling in a car, you're going up to, I don't know, 200 kilometers per hour, somehow you have to brake. And that turns out to be very tricky in space. So these are the main challenges.
Sure. And if you're traveling at 20% of the speed of light, charting a course accurately enough that you don't smash into something on the way, I'm sure, is a challenge too. But I'm really interested in how you get life there. So there's a few different ideas, right? Hypersleep, sending embryos there and growing. Maybe you might take through some of the more unusual ideas of how we get life to another star system when it takes so long to get there.
Yeah. So basically there are like four or five different concepts out there for getting life to other stars. The first one is to bring life, I mean like humans or animals, to other stars by actually putting them on a gigantic spaceship, and actually people and animals would live on that ship like they would live on Earth. Yeah. So these are gigantic ships and they're very costly, but that would be like the simplest way, or technically simplest way, to get people to another star.
Now, how big would these ships need to be?
So they're likely going to be like kilometer size. So we are really talking about like cities traveling through space.
Right. And how have we figured how many people we need? I know we had Frederick Marin on the program before, and he came up with this idea that we needed just 98 people on board a ship to survive. Would you agree with that figure? Is that what we're talking about, a city for 98 people? It seems quite big.
Yeah. So Frederick, I'm actually working with Frederick, and we are soon going to publish a joint paper which also deals with this topic of how many people do you need on such a ship. So the number Frederick came up with, it's really the absolute minimum number of people you need on such a ship. So it's really that's like really the lower end.
Okay.
But if you are on such a trip, you want to make sure that people are actually living in a comfortable environment, which means that maybe spending all your life with the same 98 people might be a little bit boring in the end, or there might be certain conflicts appearing, etc. So the idea we were thinking about in our paper is to maybe have like several of these communities, like small villages on a ship, each of them living in a separate module. Yeah, it's a separate village. And they are essentially isolated, but there are some exchanges between these villages. And then you end up with numbers which are more like in the several thousands. And that seems to be a more reasonable number than this absolute bare minimum number of about 100.
And so on this ship, we were talking about the idea of having it rotate so that there was some sense of gravity. There's, you need ways to make food. We talked about that. By the way, if you want to check out our podcast feed, you can listen back to that interview that we have with Chris Wanchek, where we kind of covered a lot of those things. But so this idea is about 1,000 people on a city the size of New York, powered by something that gets us 20% the speed of light. That's one way of doing it, right? But there are other ways which make more sense to me because they're much more doable. One of them is hibernation. And we've seen this on sci-fi, of course, but the idea that we could put people into deep sleep. What is the science on that one?
Yeah, so hibernation is a very interesting one. And for instance, the European Space Agency has recently started again to work on that topic.
Really?
Yeah, so they're really looking into this for space applications. And what's interesting about hibernation is actually that if you hibernate, so it's essentially a state of deep sleep. I mean, they're animals who, like bears, who spend like winter hibernating.
Yeah.
The reason why they do this is because they consume very little energy in that state. Yeah. And it turns out that in space, I mean, energy means that you have to eat food. And on long space trips, it's actually a problem. I mean, if you have to eat a lot, you have to provide that food. And if you have to live like 4 years on a spacecraft, then you need a lot of food.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just right now here in France in confinement, and you see that if you buy food like for 2 weeks, I mean, it's quite a lot. And if you imagine like 100 times of that for like for a trip of a couple of years, like to maybe within our solar system, it's a lot of food. And
yeah,
if you can bring down that amount of food you need by, I don't know, a factor of 10, I mean, you really decrease the amount of resources you need by a factor of 10. And that's very important in space because mass equals cost. So that's the reason why hibernation is so interesting.
Well, I mean, there's other things as well, right? I mean, you don't need to be intellectually stimulated while you're asleep. So there's that. There's the fact that less accidents are likely to happen if humans are stuck in a glass coffin. I mean, hypersleep, if we could medically induce it, would be amazing. Can we medically induce it in humans?
Yeah, so that's the big issue. And people are working on it. So there are a few researchers who are working on this for various applications, because essentially what we're talking about is like a little bit like a artificial coma, and that might be interesting for like medical applications. But one of the problems is that sustaining that in humans for extended periods doesn't seem to be very obvious, because humans, apparently, they don't seem to be like, we're not naturally able to hibernate. I mean, we are not bears, we are not animals who hibernate during winter naturally, and we have to induce it like artificially. And it turns out that right now we haven't really figured out what we have to do this and to keep in this state for extended period of times without damaging the organism. Because it turns out that even the animals who hibernate, they accumulate like toxins, essentially poison in their body during hibernation. Because the body doesn't reject these toxins, and they slowly build up. And the problem is actually we don't really know how to do this in humans without harming the organism.
What about muscle atrophy and that sort of thing? I mean, in those space movies we tend to see, they don't have room to exercise, but presumably there'd be some need to move the muscles to keep the muscles from atrophying during hibernation, or have we even started thinking about that?
I think, I mean, I'm not at all an expert on the hibernation, but usually what happens in space is that the body will use up the muscles when they are not used. I mean, essentially the body feeds off your muscles when they are not used. I mean, it's essentially food for your organism, because the body sees that, okay, you don't use your muscles, then we will simply reduce the amount of muscles you have. Now, I imagine that in hibernation, because you're using not that much energy, I assume that even the reduction in muscle mass is like probably reduced. Yeah, but
right.
that's only my educated guess.
Okay. So that is still science fiction in a way, because while we see it in some hibernating animals, we do not see it in humans at all. So we need to find a way of genetically switching that on if it exists in our DNA, which surely it must somewhere. But the most likely way that we might get this to work, to me, is frozen embryos. But it throws up some other really interesting ideas. So we already know how to freeze embryos for years. We already know how to freeze sperm for years. eggs for years. Getting those into an artificial womb is obviously taxing, but probably not impossible. But once that baby is born, even forgetting about the ethics of a child being born in a robot environment with no humans and not having been asked to be born, as many teenagers say to their parents, there are also lots of other issues with doing this. But I think it's the most obvious answer to how we get from here to somewhere else in years without people going crazy.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. If you really want to, if the problem is only bringing life to other places or human life to like other stars, then that's probably the easiest way to go, because you probably need a rather small spacecraft for doing that, putting like a kind of, I don't know, a sperm bank or and egg cells on your spacecraft, and then you launch it, and that's it. The problem with this idea is not getting to the star, but actually once you start like breeding humans, the big problem then becomes, how do we actually raise humans without humans?
Yeah.
Because we need, I mean, we actually, without social contact, the child will simply die. And that's the big problem. We need some form of, I don't know, artificial intelligence, I mean, robots or some substitute for human parents. And that's like the big challenge for that concept. And I don't think we have really figured out a way to how to get to that idea of having artificial parents.
Well, so you could have humanoid robots. We certainly have the ability, if you look at Atlas and how American robotics firms have developed humanoid-like robots, you could theoretically put soft skin on them, a face, and then program them with, you know, human interaction scenarios. But yeah, you'd have to sort of put the whole of human experience into that robot before you send it. But, you know, technically you could put a robot, you could give it a whole load of videos so we could teach kids once they got to once they had the ability to speak and read, that you could give it all the information it needed to figure out the rest of everything. So you just need to get it to 4, 5 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
Yeah,
not that that's easy. I've got a 5-year-old, and Jesus Christ, it's almost impossible. So, like, getting from 0 to 5, I'm not saying that's easy, but once you get to 5 or 6, the child could take over its own self's learning.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, imagine, if you want to really settle another, I don't know, an exoplanet, or you want to build a colony in another star system. I mean, we're talking about like hundreds of 5 or 6 year olds, and then you have like, I don't know, you can imagine like having like hundreds of these robot parents and educating this population of children. It's in principle possible. It's just that, there are so many things we haven't figured out about this, but I agree, it's in principle, it's possible. Another question is obviously, how would it be possible to educate this population in a way that they're afterwards capable of living in that settlement? I mean, that's also not straightforward, because you essentially have to encode all that knowledge into these robot parents, yeah, or maybe you have something like a holodeck, and the children are like educated
in VR,
so that might be another solution. But actually we know very little about this right now, surprisingly little, so we haven't really developed concepts for how that might be achievable.
Well, because morally it's a horror show, Andreas, that's why.
Yeah.
Because the idea of it is absolutely terrifying, and who would do that to children with no one to care? I mean, it's the cruelest of all experiments.
Yeah.
And the fourth way is obviously beyond our reach at the moment, but is intellectually very interesting, and that is the idea that if we wanted to travel from Earth to another solar system, we could find a way to upload consciousness into a computer and send that instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the most like advanced ideas, but maybe it's not that. I mean, we are still very far away from that. But we currently have a lot of discussions about AI, and there are people thinking seriously about like brain uploading.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of ideas out there, more or less serious. So we don't really know if this is feasible. But if one day it's possible, then we could essentially send a big computer, or I don't know, kind of big database to another star. And then again, the question is, what happens once we are there? I mean, either you remain stored on that computer, and then it would be essentially like robotic exploration, or you have to develop a technology to actually download consciousness to another body. And that's again a kind of crazy idea, because how should that happen? I mean, you have to like maybe recreate an organism, and then you download the brain or download consciousness into that. So again,
these are all really way out of our league so far. But the biggest question, I suppose, is why would we do it at all? I understand why we would explore the idea, because we don't know what technology will come from asking crazy ideas. I love that idea. But if we're talking about sending a one-way crew, the chances of them being able to get back or even send back information are extremely low, right? Or is the idea that we might be able to send information back to Earth? I mean, that's surely near impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's what we can safely exclude is that the people will actually return at some point to Earth. I mean that's it's really a one-way trip. In terms of information, you could send back data from another star system. So this is feasible. It could be done with existing technologies. So that's not that much of a big deal.
All right. And how quickly would we hear back?
Yeah, so we would exactly hear back after the amount of light years that star would be away from Earth. So which means that for Alpha Centauri, which is like 4.2 light years away from Earth, it would take like 4.2 years to get the data back from Alpha Centauri.
Okay. So that's not that long. I mean, all things considered, considering how long it would take to get there, 4.2 years later is only a fraction of that. So there are many challenges at the moment. How long have we been looking into this, and what do you think are the most promising technologies on our horizon that might allow interstellar travel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people have been looking into this since the 1950s. You could say something like that. So serious study of interstellar travel started 1950s, 1960s. There were a few projects like Project Orion. So it really started like in the 60s. Then in the 70s, we had Project Daedalus. So it's a huge, spacecraft the size of the Empire State Building using fusion propulsion. So that was like the first serious in-depth study of interstellar travel. Now, most recently, like in 2016, Breakthrough Starshot was announced. So Breakthrough Starshot is a project which works on laser-propelled interstellar probes. So essentially, you are using the same thing you have in a laser pointer. So it's a laser beam, but something which is like 1 billion times stronger than your laser pointer. And it turns out that if you use a laser beam with that much power, it can push things. And if you have like a 1 gigawatt laser, I mean, that's the equivalent of the power of like a power station, like a nuclear power station. If you have that much power in your beam, you can push a spacecraft with the power of, or with the force of, maybe a dozen or several dozens of chocolate bars on your hand. So that's about the force which is generated by the laser beam. So it's not that much, actually. I mean, it's really not that much. But if you do that in space, and if you do it long enough, it turns out that you can accelerate a spacecraft the size of a postage stamp to speeds of like 10 to 20% of the speed of light. So it's really like 1,000 times faster than any spacecraft we have launched into space today, but we could in principle do that. We can.
Okay, but if we're doing that with a postage stamp, because there's no resistance because they're in space, why couldn't you use the same beam for an enormous spacecraft? Do you need more force to push it? Or if there's no resistance in space because there's no matter, why wouldn't that beam work just as well on a huge spaceship?
Yeah, in principle, of course, you could do that, but that's like the difference between, I mean, imagine your car has broken down, and then you're pushing like with 10 people, or you're pushing the car like with just one person. And okay. If it turns out that if you're just pushing with one person, the car, I mean, it rolls like much slower than if you're pushing like with 10 people. And that's the same in space. If you have a laser beam which is strong enough to push a spacecraft the size of a postage stamp to these velocities, it will take much, much longer for a big spacecraft to be accelerated to these velocities. And it actually turns out that the spacecraft would take like too much time, and it would be too far away from the laser beam at that point that the laser would no longer accelerate the spacecraft. So it's essentially not possible. Not possible to do.
So we have some ideas on how we might get to the near the speed of light, although we haven't got the technology. We have some ideas for how we might hibernate, but we don't know how that would work. We don't quite know how to raise babies in space, and we don't know how to download consciousness into the brain. When, if you were to pick a number out of your hat, how quickly do you see any of these technologies converging to seeing the first human space launch towards another star?
That's a very good question. I mean, we tend to say in research that any predictions beyond like 20 years are like, it's always like 20 years in the future.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's like fusion power. So this is like a joke we make. So so the first thing is, for sending these like postage stamp sized spacecraft to another star, so Breakthrough Starshot is currently aiming for a launch date between like 2040, 2050, something like that. So that's like 20, 30 years into the future. And they're quite serious about this. So they are funding this with like $100 million to develop some technology prototypes, etc.
Wow.
So I think that's quite realistic. If you think about these other technologies for sending humans to other stars, I think we first have to test these technologies within our solar system, which means that, as the European Space Agency does, they're looking into hibernation for purposes of sending humans to Mars. So there we will find out if it really works in space for these extended periods of times. And if it works, then we might extend that to longer periods like decades or even centuries. So I think we will gradually mature these technologies within our solar system during the 21st century. And I guess that at some point, like in 200 years or 300 years, we will be able to really send humans to other stars, like these world ships or generation ships. I'm quite sure that this will be possible only in several hundreds of years.
Yeah. And I suppose the good news about making those sort of projections is you won't be around to find out if you're wrong. Really interesting speaking with you, Andreas. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
love to know what you make of those ideas, because they I mean, even just thinking about them, I think is interesting, as I said in the interview, like they all throw up both ethical, technical, engineering, all sorts of challenges. And yet to imagine them as science writers have done for you know, centuries, it's a fun way to pass the time. Now, we'll take a look at some of your emails, texts, and tweets from last week. And we did a program on ASMR, which is this emotional reaction that people have to certain experiences. Often on the internet, they tend to be people doing mundane things, but with perfect hand movements and talking closely to the microphone. And for some reason, this mixture of intimacy and hand movements and sounds causes a stimulation in the bodies of listeners who experience ASMR. I don't get this, but producer Aidan does. And so we talked about the science last week and spoke to a researcher about her work. And someone, we asked you about your experiences. And Nina says, hi, I've experienced ASMR all my life. I find it great for stress reduction and calming anxiety. My favorite triggers are eating sounds and cleaning sounds. I now have my own sweeping and cleaning ASMR channel called ASMR Nina. Oh, I've got to check that out. Actually, we can do that live because I'm in my shed and I can just Google ASMR Nina. And, okay. ASMR scrubbing a shower. No talking and no tapping. So it seems that people who experience ASMR, they'd like to know if this is going to be a tapping or a talking video or not, because it appears to be important. She's denoting each of these. So I'm watching Nina. She's putting on rubber gloves. And she has a shower that's, I mean, it looks quite clean, to be honest. And she's got a little mat there she's going to kneel on. And we're seeing this top down, so we can see the bottom, the drain of the shower. She's got some salt, just some regular table salt. And then there's a metal bowl you can hear, and she's got some bread soda. She's showing us the contents of that now. And a spoon in a metal, I'm thinking the metal bowl is metal for the sound reasons, and then we have some vinegar. So she's pouring the soda into the bowl. Is this ASMR? I'm just completely lost. How is this ASMR? I mean, she makes these videos, so I guess she knows, but this is she's pouring salt in with the baking soda. And now she's gonna pour some vinegar in. She's going to give that shower a real scrub. Just to remind you, this is not a fetish thing. This is just, it's an ASMR thing. But I like the sound there. She's mixing it up good. Yep. Yeah. And then she's, I presume, I'm just going to fast forward for your safety, because this is a 20-minute video. But now she's rubbing the mixture on the shower and give it a good old clean. I'm just going to fast forward to the end. I don't want to ruin it for you, but the shower really doesn't look that much cleaner. I mean, I'm sure it is, but it doesn't look that much cleaner because of the quality of the video. Okay, so there you go. Nina, thanks very much for your email. Look, whatever, I mean, this obviously for some people, it gives them a lot. They get a sensation of calmness and of a weird mixture of stimulation, but also relaxation. I just watched a 20-minute video of a young woman cleaning the bottom of a shower reasonably well. As I say, I worked in talk radio for a long time, and it allowed me, it afforded me the ability to turn into someone who completely and utterly sees whatever you want to do, because working in talk radio, you experience everything that people do. You hear all the really stuff that you would have said, that's stupid. And you get to speak to them as to why they do that, what you would have thought previously is stupid. And you realize actually almost everyone has a good motivation for doing the things they do. That's how people work. Okay, back to your emails and texts. Thank you very much for that, Nina. Where are we? Here. Someone says, ASMR, I've experienced it since I was a child. I'm convinced my tingles come from vibrations in the person's voice. Certain voices induce it instantly. First there was the word, and the word was God, they say. I'm not sure if that is in any way related to ASMR, or are they, is that they like hearing that sentence? Is that that it induces ASMR? Doesn't seem to match what I've heard from ASMR. Katrina says in Dublin, she says, I've had ASMR since I was a kid, but I never knew it was anything unusual until I heard of an episode of This American Life about 10 years ago, which gave it a name for me. Okay, so we're a little late to the party. We understand that, but we were looking for the science, not just the experience. And the science is only just emerging. I didn't know about the videos and can't stand them. I don't get it as much now because I'm older and busier, but my strongest experience of it are always when a middle-aged man with a very boring voice, a Germanic accent is better, presents something really dull at length in a meeting. Wow, there is an audience for everything. So you get tingles when you and the strongest experiences are when you hear a middle-aged man with a very boring voice presenting something really dull at length in a meeting. Think accounting standards. I go into a total daze. Also, walking around art galleries alone, if they are quiet, can bring it on. Unfortunately, since I listen to that podcast, when I feel it, I become aware of it, which tends to kill the sensation. Oh no, so it's like, by looking at it, you've ruined it. That's a shame. Yeah, and actually, when Julia was speaking to us on the podcast, she was talking to producer Aidan, and she was saying that that's true, that actually if you realize that ASMR is a thing and that you know about the research and that everyone's into it, then it becomes less easy for someone to achieve it, to get the sensation as strongly. Owen Kenny says, what was that Twitter account that you mentioned with the relaxing videos of when things go perfectly? Extremely satisfying is the Twitter account. You'd love it. And we were talking about animal culture last week and about the singing, the song of birds. And Jerry says, only male birds sing and the females, like all females, just whinge. Thanks for that. Right. That's it for us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Simon Keane researching, and on sound, Peter Malloy back in News Talk HQ. This Wednesday, 6 to 7:30 p.m., Facebook.com/British Council Ireland is where you'll see the FameLab Ireland final. I'll be hosting. It's a great 90 minutes of entertainment and science. I will hopefully see you then. In the meantime, stay curious.